From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with the author Martin Puchner, who has a new book out, The Language of Thieves, My Family's Obsession with a Secret Code the Nazis Tried to Eliminate. The book is published by W.W. Norton and Company. Centuries ago in Middle Europe, a coded language appeared, scrawled in graffiti and spoken only by people who were W-I-Z, wise, which means in the know. This hybrid language, dubbed Rotwelsch, facilitated survival for people in flight, whether escaping persecution or just down on their luck. It was a language of the road associated with vagabonds, travelers, Jews, and thieves that blended words from Yiddish, Hebrew, German, Romani, Czech, and other European languages, and was rich in expressions for police, jail, or experiencing trouble, such as being in a pickle. This renegade language unsettled those in power, who responded by trying to stamp it out, none more vehemently than the Nazis. As a boy, Martin Puchner learned this secret language from his father and uncle. Only as an adult did he discover, through a poisonous 1930s tract on Jewish names buried in the archives of Harvard's Widener Library, that his own grandfather had been a committed Nazi who despised this language of thieves. Martin Puchner is Byron and Anita Wien Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Harvard University, author of The Written World, and general editor of the Norton Anthology of World Literature. He lives and works in Cambridge, Massachusetts. When I spoke with him last week, I began by asking him how he came to write a book about the language of thieves. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Yeah, they're really, in a way, two moments of origin. The first, going furthest back, is when, as a child, I was inducted into this strange secret thieves language by my uncle, who was obsessed with it. He was a writer, a kind of bohemian, who really devoted his life to this language. He loved it. He incorporated it in his own poetry. He started to translate bits of world literature into this thieves language that really only he could understand. So a very, to my mind, fascinating figure. And he taught me a lot of words and expressions and so on and so forth. So that's one origin that starts very early in my childhood. And that's always been with me, and I cherish that experience. The other moment of origin is, and that's in a sense how the book really starts, is when I'm now, you know, we are now in the early to mid 90s. I'm a student at Harvard. I'm in Widener Library. And everyone has been telling me what a great library it is. You know, say one of the biggest. It's, you know, they have everything. And so, you know, one day I'm sitting in the reading room and kind of procrastinating and looking around and thinking, you know, I'm gonna test and see how good this library is. Yeah. So I first check out my uncle because he published a few of these works, these translations and his own poetry with that used part of that secret language. And they have that, and I'm really amazed. This is obscure stuff. And then I think, okay, I'm going to test it some more. I'm going to see whether they have any writings of my grandfather's, his father. Right. And I knew that the grandfather had been a historian of names that always sounded, as a child, very obscure and very, you know, specialized to me, almost comical. And I go to the card catalog, and lo and behold, they have some of his stuff, and most of it is very obscure stuff. But then I come across this article that's called Family Names as Racial Markers. It's from 34. And I start reading it, and it's this shocking experience, because it's this horrible anti-Semitic rant about Jewish-sounding German names and German-sounding Jewish names, and how it's all confused, and how he, my grandfather, is going to clear it all up. And in the middle of this rant, this horrible text, he talks about the secret language, and he, it's clear that he hates it. He wants it eliminated because it combines German, Yiddish, and Hebrew and has infiltrated official German, and it's all goes all against his idea of both racial and linguistic purity. And so, you know, I'm shocked to learn about my grandfather's past, Nazi past, which I didn't know anything about. Right. But also this weird fact that the secret language is part of it, that so that my grandfather hated it, and that then my uncle clearly somehow devoted his life to resuscitating it in some form. So that, and that really trying to understand both more about the language, because even though I had bandied around these words as a kid, I didn't really know anything about this language. And trying to puzzle out this strange family story connected to it, that then really got me started on the book.
Right, which is probably part of why your uncle, it was Gunther, is that his name?
Right.
Yeah, probably part of why he was interested also, I'm sure, had to do with understanding his father's investment in it, right? The name of the language is, why don't you say it?
So there are two names.
Yes.
The one most often used is Rottwelsch.
Okay.
Has nothing to do with Wales or Welsh. Rot in Rottwelsch means beggar. And Welsh can mean Italian, but most often it means just foreign or incomprehensible.
Right.
The way we say, oh, that sounds Greek to me, or
right.
You know.
Yeah.
So an incomprehensible beggar's cant.
Okay.
So I came
up with beggar's babble. How does that sound?
I like that.
So that's Rottwelsch. And then Zinken, is that the other word you were going to talk about?
Well, Zinken is also part of that. So Zinken, so the Rottwelsch was a purely spoken language. It didn't need to be written down. That wasn't, you know, didn't come up really in this strange world of the road. So it, you know, goes back to the Middle Ages. It really becomes sort of a language of migrations and displaced people and peddlers,
right.
People without a fixed abode. So they didn't really need writing, and many of them wouldn't be able to read and write. So purely spoken language. But there are the Zinken, a word that comes from the Latin word signum for sign, and there were these carved, we know them as hobo signs from,
yes,
the Great Depression.
Yeah.
And many of these American hobo signs actually, I realized, come from these signs that these travelers would carve into trees and foundation stones and sort of help each other navigate the road, warn each other of sort of aggressive policemen, or the one I love is the sign of the cross that tells you if you have to act piously to get some food from a particular house,
right.
You know, these kinds of signs.
Right.
Yeah, those are the Zinken, the signs, the carved signs.
And those are fun. You include some of the words and some of the signs in the book, and I have a question about that later, but that was really fun to see them. You tell an anecdote early in the, I think it's the opening of the book, you tell an anecdote of being 3 years old. I believe you were in Nuremberg, is that where you had a house? Do you want to just talk really quickly about that? That was fun.
It's true. So actually, my earliest experience wasn't even my uncle teaching me these words, but it was a Zinken, a sign. So when I was growing up in this house, just a little sort of suburban house, beggars, travelers, vagrants kept showing up at our house, ringing the doorbell. And my mother, you know, very kind-hearted person, would give them something to eat and something to drink, and then they would disappear. But it kept happening over and over again. And, you know, my mother, I think, asked around any of the neighbors, no. So why are they coming to our house? And I would, you know, watch this. And then my uncle came to visit, and she mentioned this, and he looked around and he saw that there was one of those Zinken, carved into a nearby tree, or I think it was actually chalked into the foundation, on the side of the sort of a discreet place in the house. And said, that's why, because that is the Zinken that says, you will get some food here. And they did.
Yeah.
And that was my induction. It fascinated me as a child. And I suppose it still does, because it meant that, you know, there's this other world. There are these signs and these people who live very different lives for me. And yet, if you know how to read these signs, you can get an inkling of this world.
Now, the language of Rottweilsch, which is mainly the story in your book, although your story is so interesting, it's very multi-layered. It's your personal story, but it's also the history of this language that you were able to research and discover more about. So what are the source or sources of the words in Rottweilsch for the most part?
Yeah, so I should say that linguists, strictly speaking, would consider it a sociolect, or I love this one, a professional language. because it doesn't have its own grammar. So the grammar is German or various German dialects. But most of the words, most of the sort of meaning-bearing word, you know, the verbs and the nouns and adjectives and all of that, some come from German. Some from Yiddish and through Yiddish Hebrew. Some come from Romani, the language of the Sinti and Roma, you know, falsely called the Gypsies because they were believed to have come from Egypt. Some come from Czech. So different languages in Central Europe. But the key thing is that once these words enter Rottweilsch, they change their meaning. And this is why it was not comprehensible. Hence, Welsh, Rottweilsch, right? The incomprehensible.
Right.
What did you call it? Babel?
Oh, beggar's babble.
Beggar's babble, exactly. I love that. So hence beggar's babble, because even German speakers or Yiddish speakers wouldn't be able to understand it.
Right. I mean, even words that they thought they knew actually have a different meaning at this point. Yeah.
Okay. Exactly.
And actually, I noticed that about one of the vocabulary words. The word virgin, it meant something completely different from what we associate with virgin. I can't remember what it meant, but when I read your vocabulary, I was like, well, no, that doesn't mean the same thing.
So it's individual words, and I love even more the kind of expressions that I find very evocative.
Yeah.
For example, to make a rabbit. Means, you know, not making a rabbit stew or whatnot, but it means to make like a rabbit, to make a quick escape. Uh-huh. And that's, of course, something that these people of the road who would always be somehow escaping the police or needed to do a lot. So
right.
this is in the end, for me, the sort of beating heart of the book is that this language with its characteristic expressions becomes it becomes sort of a window into this world that's otherwise so remote and inaccessible, because the language really sort of captures the what it was like to live that kind of life.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about how this discovery affected you and interacted with your personal history. You write, do you mind if I read a couple sentences? You write early on, "The biggest mystery was why my own family was so strangely entangled with this secret language." And then I'm going to skip a little bit, and you write, "The process of researching this history brought me face to face with family secrets and evasions, with historical guilt and attempts at atonement." And that just brought it really, it made it so interesting to read, because this is a much more personal investment than just a regular history book. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in many ways, it starts with these two origins we talked about, both as sort of childhood, memories of being in some ways introduced to this language, and then this discovery about my grandfather. But then I should say, subsequently, I inherited the archive of my uncle's, because he died very early of a brain aneurysm. And so I inherited this archive and have been carrying it around with me for a long time, and always thought that I want to do something with that at some point. And I thought, okay, so sooner or later, I want to write a book about Rottweilsch and that strange language that few people know about. But then more and more I become to realize that no, that family story that's part of it, that's part of why I even know about this, has to be part of this book, and including this very painful discovery about my grandfather. And so, you know, I started to research that. I started to wonder, why did I never know about my grandfather's past during the Third Reich? And I started, you know, I had difficult conversations with different family members about that. And it became more and more clear to me that this wasn't going to be just a book about a secret language. It was also a book about how, in a sense, this family secret was passed down from one generation to the next. Yeah. So there was a moment in the 60s when my father and this uncle discovered that their father had been somehow entangled with the Nazi regime, and they confronted him and had a big blow up. But then that was a strange thing for me, that somehow that topic disappeared from conversation again, was buried again. And so I had to rediscover this whole history by chance in Widener Library. So thinking about that, thinking about how the secret was sort of discovered and then reburied and just uncovered again, became part of what I felt like I needed to write about, in part because it was so entangled with this question of Rotwelsch and why my family was connected to it.
Yeah, it's interesting because in another situation, it might have just become part of the family history, something that everyone understood and regretfully knew had happened, right? But in order to make sense of it, you have to make sense of fond memories of a grandfather or father, in the case of your father and uncle, and the truth that you didn't ever know. And making sense of that it's impossible, you know, or it was for them, it seems. So they had to just not talk about it.
I think that's right. And I think they didn't talk about it explicitly, but I thought about it, it became clear that this knowledge really shaped some of the things they did. I mean, I think it shaped, in my uncle's case, clearly his lifelong devotion to Rotwelsch. Mm-hmm. And also in my father's case, I mean, he was an architect, but he wrote poetry, and I looked at, so my father also died a long time ago in an accident. And so going through his papers and his effects, I could see in some sense traces mm-hmm. of this secret. And so it's very clear that, yeah, I think you put it really beautifully. It's part of who they were and what they did. But somehow they didn't feel like they could talk directly about
it. Yeah, it's interesting because in a way it's in keeping with the subject matter, because Rotwelsch in some ways is about not talking, being a little obscure. But you write, Rotwelsch has taught me a lesson. We speak not only to reveal our thoughts, but also to hide them by making sure no outsider can understand. That's a little paraphrase of something you wrote, which reminded me that when I was a kid, we used to visit friends who the family were from Chile, and they would break into Spanish whenever they didn't want us to understand what they were saying. And literally, I really do credit that for why I became a Spanish major one day.
That's great.
I think it's fascinating when you realize someone's trying to say something and not let you understand it, right?
And I think that's exactly how from different sources one can reconstruct how that language was used. It was people who you know, most people wouldn't grow up with Rotwelsch as their first language. They would adopt it once they drifted into this itinerant underground. Which also means that they, you know, this itinerant, even though there was a lot of Yiddish and through Yiddish Hebrew in it, most of the speakers weren't necessarily Jewish. It was really a kind of hodgepodge, you know, Christians, Protestants, Catholics, Jewish paddlers, maybe sometimes Sinti, Roma, whoever drifted into this milieu and stayed in it would sooner or later be inducted into it. And so, which meant that they were all bilingual, and you know, we call it code switching, that they would do depending on the situation, they would code switch. And that's right. That's I think exactly what you're describing.
Exactly right. Another anecdote you told in the book, which I just loved, is that you were watching Mad Men, and in one of the scenes in Mad Men, it's like a flashback from Draper's memories from his real life. There's a Zinken, and you like jumped up and exploded in excitement.
It was amazing, yeah, because you know, I kept mulling over the story, both the personal story and the Rootvrouw story, I kept thinking, you know, what does this have to do with America, you know, mm-hmm. today? Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know very much about these hobo signs, and I think it was one of that that episode really drove that point home, because there is this hobo there's a flashback and we suddenly see young childhood Don Draper on the farm run by his stepdad, his evil stepdad, and a hobo comes by and is asks to work and works for a day in exchange for, you know, a bed for the night and a quarter. The next morning, asks for the quarter, but the evil stepdad cheats him out of the quarter and just thinks, go away. So he leaves angrily, the hobo, and young Don Draper follows him to the, you know, the edge of the road and observes him carve that sign into the tree that I immediately recognized, because it was a Rootvelsh Zinken, which said, an evil man lives here, you know, don't trust this person. It's sort of a sickle is the sign.
It's both fascinating that you saw that, but it also makes me have even more respect for Mad Men.
Yes, exactly. No, it's true. It's a you know, the fancy. I mean, it's great in Mad Men because you have the glitzy world of Madison Avenue, but then much of the show revolves around the fact that Don Draper comes from a very different world.
Right. It reminds me. So my family, my husband's family name is Shapiro, but everybody else in the world says Shapiro. But in Philadelphia and Baltimore, they always said Shapiro. And that was the family lore. And I was like, oh, come on, really? Seriously? But then we were watching The X-Files once, which takes place outside of Baltimore, of course. And Fox Mulder at one point says, Mrs. Shapiro called. And we all, like, in the room, we all went, ah! Sorry. Okay.
No, it's, you know, in a way, that's what's so fascinating about my grandfather, that this topic that he wrote about, family names, it is a fascinating topic. I mean, we could talk, you know, forever about it, the history and why, how it's pronounced and where it comes from and what people associate with it. And that's so heartbreaking about it, because it's such a fascinating story, a topic, but he used it for such terrible ends.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the research you did for this book. And actually, I'm also curious how your uncle would have done research, because these are much different times. So let's talk a little bit about researching Rootvelsh. And in addition, I'd love to know if you had any great surprise source as you were working that you suddenly had a big aha moment.
Yeah. So in terms of the research, so yes, I relied a lot on my uncle's archive. And the thing, so I mentioned earlier that the language was purely spoken, you know, purely oral language. So you might ask, so how do you know about it at all?
Right.
If it wasn't written down. And so the thing is, of course, it was written down, not by the speakers, but by a group that thought they had a keen and professional interest in this language and knowing this language. And that was the police.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, because to the extent that this language was associated with the underground, the police felt like, oh, we need to understand what these, you know, potential criminals are talking about. And there's always the slightly paranoid idea that, oh, they have actually concocted this secret language precisely for the purpose of sort of hiding their nefarious plots and so on and so forth. That isn't quite true, but that's what the archive suggests. Why? Because it's a police archive. So over, you know, centuries, police, different policemen, different jurisdictions assembled essentially a long vocabulary list. You know, they would arrest someone. They realized that, oh, this is a Root Welsh speaker. Let's squeeze some more words out of this person before we, you know, let them go or whatever. So there, that's the written record. And so this is essentially what my uncle used. And there were also, so there was, for example, one policeman in the 19th century who's a very interesting figure who, even though he also, you know, thought that, I want to kind of decode this cipher, you know, the secret code. He nevertheless, he was sort of almost like a scholar and linguist. So there was, of course, a lot of prejudice always projected onto this criminal language, Jewish language, rife with anti-Semitism. So my grandfather was far from alone in making that association. So a very prejudiced archive, but this policeman was very became fascinated by this language and really studied it. And so that for example is one of the sources that my uncle then assembled. He photocopied some from libraries. A few sources were published for various reasons. There was one dictionary of it that was published sort of in the middle of the 20th century. So books, different sources that he copied from archives, but he also went to do field search, so to speak. He hung out in dive bars and he chatted up people. He was had a very easy way of talking with all kinds of people. Sort of part of his bohemian, you know, identity. And so he assembled these hundreds and hundreds of expressions of these words, you know, these kind of 4x6 index cards. And so that's part of his archive too. So various sources.
Now, could you rely on what the police uncovered, or did you come up with enough alternating information to think, okay, so they were lying to the police?
So that became a fascinating, you're putting your finger exactly on a kind of crucial point here. The whole archive in a sense is hostile. It's a hostile archive. And yet it's fantastic. It's all we have. If not for these policemen, you know, this language would have disappeared. So it becomes a very ambivalent thing. And I realized that you have to kind of read, the archive is all you can rely on, but you have to sort of read it against the grain. So one aspect of that is that point about the deliberate obfuscation, that the idea that these policemen say again and again, that these criminals concoct their secret language just so against us, you know, against the forces of law and order. And that it's very clear that that's not how languages actually emerge. Mm-hmm. Languages emerge from a, you know, shared life experience, this kind of community, a kind of community of those on the road, people who leave Zinken for each other. So that's really how a sociolect emerges. Secrecy is not entirely irrelevant, but it's more of a byproduct, probably. You know, that's what the word Welsh means. Every language is a secret language for someone who doesn't speak it, you know. But you're also right to question, you know, were they lying to the police? And that point, you know, I wondered about that and worried about that. Is that even reliable information? And at the very end, and this is how I end the book, actually, is that I finished the book at the American Academy in Berlin. And while there, a journalist wrote an article about this project. And all kinds of people started to email me about sort of sightings of Root Welsh or some experience they had connected to it, including a wonderful young man from Switzerland who said that for complicated reasons, he had a connection to an itinerant group in Switzerland, and that spoke a language that was related to Root Welsh, still speaking it. And so we struck up a correspondence, and then he said, you know, by the way, I'm going to meet with them tomorrow. If you have any questions,
oh, wow,
you know, email me. So I did. And from the responses and the, you know, through this go-between, I never met them myself. They wouldn't. But what came clear in my correspondence with him, in the indirect correspondence with this group of people, they didn't want to tell me their names, even coming back to names, was that they were extremely distrustful of the police, certainly, but of anyone, including someone like me, who was there to research their language. And so they said that, yes, when linguists come to us with questions, we just make stuff up because we don't want them actually to know our language. Sure. And they also said that when they have a feeling that one of their words sort of has gotten out and somehow has gotten into wider circulation, as some words did. This is what drove my grandfather so mad, that Rootwelsch terms had actually filtered into German, that they, this group said, then we start using, we stop using that word, actually, because again, we don't, we did this, so this very high level of distrust mm-hmm. of anything having to do with the state and any outsider. So yeah, so I think you're absolutely right. There one has to look at this archive with a great deal of skepticism, and as I said, sort of try to read it against the grain and compare different parts of it to other parts and sort of form a composite picture of it, and I think one can, but you never know 100%.
Right. You know, it's interesting, the evolution of language. My mother-in-law speaks Yiddish, and I think as a child she spoke mostly Yiddish at home, even though she was born in America. But her parents spoke Yiddish, and she has funny little things that she says in English that are just not what I'd ever heard before, right? And one of them is to make a party. We're going to make a party. And I would always say, Debbie, it's throw a party. What are you talking about? And then one time I said to her, how do you say that in Yiddish? And she said it, and then she translated it, and it was make a party. And I realized, so that is like coming into our language, maybe or maybe not with enough people that it would actually change what we say. But it was just interesting, that moment, you know, when you realize these tiny little things.
Yeah, absolutely. Now it's interesting how then one language sort of leaves traces on another language.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's see. I want to talk again about there's a lot going on in this book, and it's about cultural and personal history. It's etymology. There's even a little suspense because there's probably a number of cases of this, but one example is that you mention your aunt Roswitha a number of times as somebody that might be somebody you'll talk to. And then I don't want to give away what happens there, but she sounds like an incredible person. Is she still living?
She is, yeah. She is an incredible person.
Has she read the book?
So she has, yes.
That's interesting. Okay, I won't go any further with that, but that was suspenseful and wonderful. The other thing I really loved is that you did share some of the vocabulary, the Rootwelsch vocabulary, but you did so in a very interesting way. After a chapter, you would contextualize the chapter with a list of Rootwelsch vocabulary. And it was so much fun. Do you want to talk about how you came up with that?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you like it. I like it too. It became a way of sort of looking back at the chapter, and also though because you know there's a lot of sort of heavy material in the book having to do with Nazi Germany and the persecution of these speakers and so on and so forth. But at the same time, I also wanted to tap into these earliest childhood experience of this language where I just loved this language and fell in love with it and its sort of earthy wit and capture some of that fun aspect. So I felt like that was probably another motivation why at the end of each chapter I had a little sort of language primer. So from the beginning I thought, you know, one of the hopes, and I suppose not entirely unlike my uncle's project, the hope that someone who reads this book gets a little bit of a sense of this language. And, you know, I sprinkle different words and phrases throughout, but then at some point, well, if I really want to do that, then I should have these little vocabulary lists. And I think I had sort of had that in the back of my mind as I was writing the book, but I was focused on other things. The book was very technically difficult to write because I interweave these stories. But then, as I mentioned, I finished it in at the American Academy in Berlin, and there was there are two wonderful writers there, Jesse Ball and Catherine Lacey, and we talked about the book, and they came up also sort of independently with this idea of you should have vocabulary lists, and I thought yes, you know, at some point I had sort of planned that, but lost track of that thought. And so when they said it, I at least partially have to credit them. Yeah. Then I thought, yes, it's the thing to do. And at this point, I was almost done and said, okay, so I'll add that dimension. So both people can get more of a sense of the chapter, but also to add a kind of a different tone to it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. It's true. It did sort of like pull even kind of heavier moments back into something a little bit more, I guess, fun, but also intellectual. You know, it just engages us in a different way than a story being told. Let's see. Now, in the course of your research, you did learn of other underground languages. So that was just a little moment that I thought was interesting. Are you now encouraged to look at those or not so much? Have you done this?
Well, you know, in a way, I am. As you mentioned, you know, I always thought of this Rotwelsch thing and my connection to it as sort of this special, very particular, very unique thing.
Right.
And in many ways, I think it is in its particularities. But as I started to research it properly, I realized that, and this became fascinating to me, that it's in a sense also the most common thing, that everywhere where you have a group that's either, you know, a minority or a repressed group or a group that has a very distinct identity that's different from the majority language and the majority society, something like a Rotwelsch, something like a distinct sociolect emerges. What's unusual about Rotwelsch is that it's so long-standing that it became, you know, existed from the Middle Ages to some extent to this day, that it had this particular combination of languages. But as a larger phenomenon, it's far from unique. It's almost universal. Mm-hmm. So I started to look a little bit at some of these other languages like it. You know, the Cockney rhyming slang in London, for example, would be an example. There is a even closer, in some sense, a language spoken in Persia and Iran called Lotarai that was also based on a lot of Hebrew because it was spoken by Jewish merchants and became sort of a secret or professional language among that particular group. From what I described to you with that article where people started to write to me about Rotwelsch, now, you know, when the Times wrote a review of this book when it just came out, all kinds of people have been emailing me about, oh, do you know about this secret language, that secret language? And so it's been actually great. And in some cases, I knew about them. In some cases, I didn't. And so I could now write a whole nother book about all the other, you know, sociolects. So that's great fun.
Let's not skim over what you just said. The New York Times reviewed this book, which is very exciting. And congratulations.
Yes, it is. It is very exciting. I never thought that a book about this obscure language and my completely obscure and, in, you know, irrelevant family would actually be reviewed by the Times. I appreciate that.
Let's see. I wondered how it was writing this book during our current American moment. I was curious how that was for you.
Yeah, you know, that's such a good question, because when the origins of the book and the drivers of the book are very different. They're very personal. They have to do with, you know, this personal history, this family history, right, in a way that the history of Germany. And so for the longest time, I thought about this as a book as looking back at my country of origin, my German family, and so on and so forth. That really was the driver when I started to write this book, you know, during the Obama era. But then, you know, suddenly, you know, after 16 and when I started to really sit down to write it, suddenly it became this eerie experience that what I was writing about, there were these echoes. You know, I had to think a lot about my grandfather. What made him become this horrible anti-Semite? What was this obsession with purity, this hatred of migrants and migratory words and so on and so forth? And then, you know, all around me, there was something related to it happening in America, and it was deeply disturbing. Mm-hmm. And shocking. And, you know, I don't want to make easy Nazi analogies, but as someone who, you know, as someone who grew up in Germany and as someone who is so immersed in this history, during these last 4 years, I couldn't help but, you know, constantly think about these echoes. So it became...
Well, Charlottesville alone, right?
Well, Charlottesville, but, you know, borders, you know, because, you know, yes. Well, the speakers were all about bumping up against borders, people who didn't have passports, who didn't have documentation, who were chased from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. It became really also a book about the modern state and borders, national borders, and groups that whose life depended on crossing them. And so, yeah, so and it's not that I had, you know, that it's not about, oh, history is repeating itself in some direct way, or that I had a particular, you know, I don't know, prediction to make. It's more like a constant range of echoes that cut across different moments in German history and the history of these speakers.
Yeah. Okay, great. I do always like to ask my guests if they've read any books lately that they would recommend, just one or two titles, books by other people that my listeners might enjoy knowing about. Do you have any that pop to mind?
Yeah. I've been doing a lot of reading, as I think, I guess, many of us have. I wouldn't say that's the good thing about the lockdown, but right. It's certainly, if you're a reader, it's been, if you're, you know, personal life circumstances allowed you some free time. So I've been reading a lot. Because I just mentioned these two novelists I befriended and who urged me to write, to add these vocabulary lists, yes. I'll just mention them, because one of them, Catherine Lacey, has just come out with a new book called Pew. P-E-W, so as in a church pews.
Okay.
And she's a wonderful, she's a fascinating novelist. She's quite young, has already published a lot of novels and short stories. These are short novels that often lead you into these sort of strange worlds. Pew is the story of a young person who doesn't even have a name. I mean, in some sense, it's even connected to what we're talking about. Oh, wow. And who sort of sleeps in church pews and then gets adopted by, you know, it's sort of almost like a kind of itinerant feral kind of person. Oh. And who then gets adopted by this church community. And then you slowly, they start to, even though they're very kind, they want to, you have the need to give this person a name. So she refuses to give a name, but they then start to call her Pew, and you begin to see how society and the norms and expectations of the society start to assert themselves. So anyway, it's a great novel, Pew, yeah. By Catherine Lacey.
Wonderful. Okay, great. Let's see. Now, I always like to finish with a question about advice for other writers. And in your case, I thought I would ask how it was different from other research projects you've undertaken. What advice you might offer to other writers who are embarking on a nonfiction story that involves a personal connection, maybe a family connection or some other personal connection? I imagine that was a bit different this time around than the written world.
Yeah, it was very different. In my previous book, The Written World, that you mentioned, I make an occasional appearance as sort of just as a kind of observer or as a camera eye through which I look at these. It's in part a travel book also, but this was felt very different, and it was hard in many ways. In part because it was about such difficult and hard topics having to do with the family. There were definitely quite a few moments. And also the historical material is very dark, where I felt like, you know, I could only spend X number of hours working on this, and then I needed to kind of turn away.
Yes. Right.
I will also say, and I mean, this is everyone who writes about their family probably has an experience like that. Many members of my family have reacted in a very hostile way to it. Some are no longer speaking to me.
Oh, dear.
So I guess I'll say think twice about it. I mean, I'm still glad I did it. And I hope that they just need some time, because it does require time. It took me many, many years to even get started on this project. Maybe that's another piece of advice. You know, I made this initial discovery in the mid-90s, but then didn't actually start writing the book until 5 years ago, or 5-6 years ago. So it took me a long time to kind of work this through and work this out. Yes. in many ways. So finding the right time is when it's the right time for you to write this book.
Well, thank you. That's great advice. I just want to mention again, the name of the book is The Language of Thieves, My Family's Obsession with a Secret Code the Nazis Tried to Eliminate. It's written by Martin Puchner, my guest today, and it's published by Norton. Martin, I really enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Great conversation. It's great to be back on the show.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And that was an interview with Martin Puchner about his new book, The Language of Thieves, which is published by W.W. Norton & Company. You can learn more about his work at his website, which is martinpuchner.com. You can also find an earlier conversation that I had with Martin about his previous book, The Written World, on the podcast site. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Martin Puchner. Take one piece of research, a photograph, a document, an object, and contemplate not only what it says, but how it got into your hands. How many people handled it before you? What kinds of institutions and the people working for them preserved them? How did these objects come into being, and how did they survive? Hopefully, in asking these questions, you'll discover the biographies of these objects. They will become full interlocutor and not just props. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. So, we're in December. The pandemic is still, not only is it still out there, it is raging in certain places, and it's really spiked in Vermont. So as I do every week, I'm encouraging you to please be safe and keep your friends and neighbors and family safe. Follow the state protocol, wear a mask, be careful. And if you can, please try to find the books that have come out, even as book tours have been canceled due to COVID. I hope that you're able to read and to write. And do keep in mind that the archives of the show offer weekly writing prompts to help you in your work, just like the one I just offered that was suggested by Martin Puchner, my guest this week. So have a look at the podcast site if you'd like to see all kinds of prompts. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. If you like the show, please rate it wherever you get your podcasts. Like it on Facebook. Talk about it, tweet about it. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, all the places that you get your podcasts. You can also visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. Actually, I should interrupt myself. If you get your podcasts in a place that does not seem to have Write the Book, I'd love it if you'd let me know. You can email me at writethebook@gmail.com. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.